Howdy and welcome to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. Good to be home. Tell you a little bit about that. And good to be back talking with you. Great podcast in store for you today. A puppy development expert, bird hunter and kennel owner, breeder, trainer, Mark Fulmer from Sarah Setter's Kennels is ready to talk with us about all the things that get his dogs to pointing, backing, and retrieving at 12 weeks. A whole bunch of other stuff to cover with Mark that will be of value to you no matter where you are in your training career. Plus a whole lot of other stuff. Let's see here. We'll go into a deep dive into feeding your dog for peak performance with an expert, sled dog racer, veterinarian, dog food developer, Tim Hunt. We'll also take a look at, exploring an area that doesn't get a lot of press, but should in our This Land Is Your Land segment. So lots to talk about here, and may as well just get it started. Been on the road for a bit, some technology issues that I'm working out were a little bit of a surprise, frankly, in this day and age, but we're getting there. And now I have a brand new computer, so maybe you can relate. When I got back, more and more pigeons on nests. Some of the squeakers are getting big enough to move around a little bit. Anybody else out there seeing a population explosion in their pigeon loft? So far, everybody I've talked to has had birds like mine multiplying all winter. And that's a good thing because we're back to working with live birds here on Flick. On the table, on the ground, steadiness to shot and fall. Already pretty good on the flight, so that's not an issue. And that freezer full of frozen pigeons is coming in handy because every time he does things right, he gets a mouthful of pigeon. How about yourself? How was your weekend? How was your season? I asked on Facebook a couple days ago, and I'm actually really excited about what I see. I asked you to describe your peak experience of last bird season, and boy, did I get some great stuff. David Gutkowski, blue grouse hunting in Colorado during a wildfire. There's a glow in the background. He's sitting there with a German short-haired pointer. And David, I hate to say it, but I can almost relate to that, almost all of it, and I'd rather not go through it again. Brad Ward celebrated a 30-year anniversary hunting with a buddy there and all sorts of high cover, I guess is the best way to describe it. Luckily, I should say, that dog did get a nice vest to protect itself. Nick Spurlock is bragging just a little bit, and I'm going to watch the video as we do this. First bird at 4 months for this dog, even retrieved to hand. And here he comes back. Oh, it's a nice, good-looking pointer. Black and white pointer. Got a little quail in the desert and bring it all the way back to Nick. Congratulations to both of you. John Wymore hunted chuckers in the Mojave Preserve with Bodie, and it looks like they had a good time. And boy, John, I ought to call you the next time I'm headed that way because I'd love to explore that area. Sean Porter is relating to highs and lows both. His poodle pointer, Bodo, hardly can tell it's a poodle pointer from all the cockle burrs all over him. But with a name like Bodo, he can't be anything but a poodle pointer. He said he got full of cockle burrs on his first duck hunt, but it did not slow him down, and that is very clear. I hope you both had a good time, and congratulations. And finally, Kevin McLaughlin, just an incredible hunt with nonstop bird action. What a beautiful shot. Brittany in the mid-ground between Kevin and a big pile of birds. Glad to see it. Glad everybody was safe, and good job to everyone who contributed to that discussion on Facebook. All sorts of other stuff going on over there, including our celebration of the places we go, the beauty that we experience. So if you haven't kicked in your own suggestions, now's a good time to do it. Take a look at it at the Wing Shooting USA Facebook page or the Upland Nation Facebook page. Just about ready for Mark Fulmer at Sarah Setter Kennels, but first a couple brief words. Sage and Breaker gun care products are crafted at the highest caliber. Learn more about them at sageandbreaker.com. Always free shipping. Watch the videos. Get on the mailing list so you have the first shot at all the new stuff as it comes out. And then speaking of stuff, if you're looking for stuff and you don't really want to buy it new, then go to uplandnationdeals.com. That's where we're taking in stuff and selling it back to you, brokering it basically. So if you have something you want to sell to a fellow bird hunter, that's the place to start as we market it to everybody else. Learn more at uplandnationdeals.com. Well, I promised you somebody with a slightly different look at puppy development, and maybe you can apply some of his philosophy and learn something from it as well. So welcome to the Upland Nation podcast, Mark Fulmer with Sarah Setter Kennels. You there, Mark?
I am here.
Good. And good to talk with you. I'm intrigued with what you're doing out there, which is why I thought we should talk on the podcast. But before we get into that, how's your day going?
I've had a fabulous day. I've shot 7 birds out of 9 today for a puppy that's leaving in a couple of days. And the next to the last bird that she pointed today, and I walked in and flushed it, shot it for her, and she picked it up for a retrieve, and she made a big loop, and as she was coming back to me, she pointed with a bird in her mouth. So I walked up and flushed that bird and shot it. It fell. She ran out and picked up the new bird. So it's great, and I got the picture also.
Oh, there's no doubt about that, and that's the kind of thing we all live for. We might get it once or twice in a dog's lifetime, and at 16 weeks, that's just remarkable. But that's kind of what we're going to talk about first. But before we get into that whole idea of your progressive early natural development program for puppies, who is Sarah?
Well, Sarah was my first bird dog. I actually bought her from my brother for $35 in 1976. I'd been taking care of his dog anyway, and she was basically mine, so I paid the $35, and Sarah taught me how to bird hunt as a high schooler.
Oh, isn't that funny? You know, so many guys use the same line, that the dog taught you to hunt, and I'm in the same boat. I just took to it a little bit later in life than you did. So, right. So tell me a little bit about your operation there.
Well, I actually had another career. I worked on a golf course for 17 years and was assistant green superintendent and field trial dogs on the golf course. And of course, a golf course is perfect because it's long and narrow, and you teach your dogs to run to the front, and they choke up when you get to the green, and when you get on the tee, you blow the whistle, and away they go again. So I had dog of the year first year I started field trialing because I had a great place to train. And that sort of got me started on the field trialing bird dogs, and I did walking trials for about 10, 11 years. And in 91, I decided I wanted to be a gun dog trainer, and I walked in the house one day and told that I was quitting my job and I was going to train dogs for a living, and they thought I was crazy.
Do they still think that?
No, I've been at it now for 30 years, and both of my parents are gone, but they were very proud in what I had built before they left.
I love it. Well, what about that whole game that you're in now? The golf game, don't get me started, because we probably both have horror stories there. But what about the bird dog training business? What do you love most about that?
Probably the people. You know, when I decided to train dogs, I looked at the field trial world and decided it was too fickle. If you were winning, you had everybody's dog in for training or handling, and if you were losing, you couldn't get a dog. And I just decided I was going to go with high-end gun dogs. And so that's where I started, and that's where I stayed for 30 years.
And in that time, have there been some real high points, some kind of peak moments that you might think of?
I had fortune to meet a friend named Greg Oyer, and he introduced me to Jim Dobbs, and I had the good fortune of spending time with both of them on a plantation in South Georgia, probably 8 or 10 weekends, 4 or 5 years. And the two of them truly stimulated me to think about dog training. And I describe them both as mentors.
And you couldn't pick a better one than Jim. And I remember the days when I was booking speakers at sportsman shows, and I'd book Jim and Phyllis in every year at every show I was working on. And they always had a standing room only crowd. They really knew what they were talking about. So I'm glad to hear that.
Because he had the good fortune to have Tritronic sending him around the country. You know, he worked with all types of trainers, whether it was pointing dogs or retrievers or flushing dogs or, you know, protection dogs or border collies. I mean, you name it. He went to the best in every dog sport, hound people. He spent time with all of the best trainers in the hound sport, and he brought things from the retriever world to the hound people and things from the hound people to the bird dog people. Because he was, you know, crossing the boundaries, and he was seeing things that people in those other realms hadn't thought about yet. So, he did a tremendous amount of good with what he's one type of training to another type of training.
You know, we've all seen that in action. We've, you know, I've had good friends who've never had a gun dog in for training, but they're obedience trainers or they're cow dog trainers, and we can all pick up something from them. And I, one of the bigger kind of forehead slapping moments I had was when I realized people like Jim Dobbs and George Hickox train all those other types of dogs for all those other types of work as well. And I now understand why they're such great trainers. They're thinking more horizontally than a lot of us, and it seems to work if we just keep our minds open to it. Have you? Can you give me an example of anything like that that you're doing that was affected by that kind of more, you know, out of the box thinking?
Well, I pretty much still train any dog that comes along. You know, I take all breeds for obedience for the most part, and the only thing I don't really train are water retrievers. I don't have a pond on the property, and if you're not in the retriever business, it's just not cost effective to load up one dog to go to a pond. I train them all, and, you know, I learn from all of them. Now, I'll tell you something that happened here while we were thinking about Jim Dobbs. Jim was here in 91, I believe, and back then I was training dogs on an upright barrel because I'd heard of barrel training, but I'd never seen it, and I didn't know that people barrel on the side, but yeah. I had it working for me.
I love
and
it.
I had it put on top of the barrel because it got hot in the sun, and one day I realized that the dog had learned to stand on the piece of carpet, and if I moved the carpet and put it on the ground, the dog would stand on the carpet. And what I was doing was, you know, basic bird work. I'd pull out a pigeon, show it to a dog, let it flap once or twice, put it away and praise him, and gradually build the dog's composure in the presence of game until he'd stand there and let me drop birds on the ground that fly off and he'd remain standing. But Jim watched me take that piece of carpet and throw it about 10 feet away, and then I just picked up the dog off the barrel and walked over and got down over the piece of carpet and basically dropped the dog from about 6 inches off the ground. And, you know, when the dog caught its balance, it sort of froze, and I immediately said, "Whoa, we stand still." So then I walk out in front of the dog and drop a bird, and it flies off and shoot the gun, and the dog's standing on the carpet. And Jim says, "Why'd you do that?"
I'm going to go buy a piece of plywood.
Well, the rest of the story.
Yeah.
Jim, on Tuesday, he called me and he said, "We're going to call it the place command." I said, "What?" He said, "That carpet, when you picked it up and dropped it on the ground, we're going to call it place command." So the birth of the place command happened here. And Jim, because of what he had seen and done, put it all together. That's where the place command came from, and it truly is in every dog sport in the world now.
I love it.
And it's been 30 years since that happened.
Well, you know, that's a good place to start our discussion about this kind of unique outlook you have about developing puppies. You call it the SPEND program, Sarah Setter's Progressive Early Natural Development Program. And it's built on some psychology that has been around for a long time in the human world. But why don't you explain it to us in the dog world?
Okay. Well, I tell you, what got me started on it was I read an article Larry Mueller put in Outdoor Life in the mid to late 80s. And in that article, he quoted someone that said a puppy's brain at 7 weeks old is 55% in size in relation to its body weight. And at 12 weeks, the brain is 95% in size in relation to an adult dog. And that stuck with me, that period of rapid brain growth. And I started reading and doing research on child development and realized that it was truly a critical period in a puppy's life when there's this period of rapid brain growth. And when you actively train through that period, it enhances the brain development for the rest of the puppy's life. You know, and that said, there have been trillions of dogs that didn't have anything special and they were fine. But this is truly a way to make puppies better. And after reading that and all the early development stuff, I started clicker training in the 80s with an e-collar, with the tone on the e-collar, because I'd never heard of a clicker.
Mm-hmm.
I read Karen Pryor's book and Condition Reinforcer. And so the only thing I could think of off bat hand was using the tone on the e-collar. So I became very proficient in using the tone as a positive reinforcer. And I just couldn't put an e-collar on a seven-week-old puppy to have a clicker type thing. And I actually came across a video that Karen Pryor and Gary Wilkes did in 1993 where they introduced training with a clicker. And as soon as I saw it, it was like, Eureka. Now I know how to train puppies. So I started developing this puppy program, I don't know, 94, 95. First thing I did was I kept puppies longer, and people didn't like that. They all want them at 7 or 8 weeks because that's what you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
And, so I got past that. First I was working only on the obedience part of the training, where I was doing extra clicker training and teach them to come and teach them to get in the kennel, walk on the lead type stuff. And, then I realized I needed to pair it with bird work. And I started taking puppies to the field at 7.5, 8 weeks of age and literally dropping birds on their heads. And I need to go back and explain why that works. I thought about it a lot. And every wild animal in the world brings back hunts. And those babies are actually fed that by the parents. When they go off of mother's milk. So I thought, So I started playing with it. And you know, the first time I fed a fresh kill quail to a pup, scared to death that it was going to eat a bone and, you know, not make it. And well, I have now fed thousands of quail to probably 1,000 puppies. And I've never had a single puppy have an incident. And the key is it's natural. It's what every animal does. The animals are imprinted on what they need to look for the rest of their lives as a food source. So I actually don't offer any type of supplemental food except mother's milk right up until when the puppies are weaned. And, you know, part of that aids you in selection of breed stock. You find the mothers that are able to raise puppies and find mothers that aren't. And as far as I'm concerned, I don't care how good of a bird dog the mother is, if she's not capable of raising a litter of puppies, she doesn't need to be in the breeding program. So I started eliminating dogs that didn't produce enough milk to care for puppies naturally. But then I would actually feed fresh kill quail for 3 to 4 days as they go off of mother's milk. And then they would immediately switch to dry dog food. And that occurred around 6 weeks of age. And by 8 weeks of age, I'm out in the field literally dropping live birds over a 4 foot fence right on top of the puppies' heads. And of course, when they smell it, they're thinking mealtime, and they try to grab it, and they don't have the coordination, and the bird runs between the legs and gets away, and they immediately start looking for it. Within 3 or 4 days, I'm at a point where I'm just tossing birds down, and they're flying away, and the puppies are trying to follow them. And at that point, their vision is so poor, if a bird flies more than 10 yards, they can't follow it. But as they approach 9 weeks of age, all of a sudden they can mark a bird 25 yards, and they'll go to it, flash point it, maybe two or three a flash point, and one a back. And very quickly, they learn to point, and half the litter learns to back. And by, 10 weeks, I got most of the litter pointing and at least half backing. And in 11 weeks, the whole litter is pointing and backing. And as they grow, they actually start covering more and more land.
Oh, yeah.
By the time they're at 12 weeks, they're hunting over 14 acres, finding birds that I put out when I don't even know where they are. And they truly learn how to hunt. They learn how to develop patterns. And they develop a tremendous amount of drive to go find those birds.
Wow.
And when it's paired with flicker training, which influences brain development, I truly feel that it influences enough brain development that the puppies are smarter for the rest of their lives.
Well, I can't argue that. No, not at all. I'm a big believer.
Yeah, you can't regain that magic window.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'll tell you what it really equates to. They tell us that children can learn multiple languages up until about 6, and the brain is very plastic and still growing. Well, it's the same thing with puppies. They can learn a tremendous amount while that brain is actively growing. That ability to learn new things slows down as the brain matures or reaches full stage.
Wow. Hey, by the way, you're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, the host. That's Mark Fulmer with Sarah Setter Kennels in Aiken, South Carolina. Mark, before we go on, you gotta clue us in. The whole idea of feeding quail to puppies, I mean, what's the point in all of that?
Well, it is truly what nature does. Nature provides every animal with the game that they're going to need to be looking for the rest of their lives to survive. It's how mama teaches it.
Yeah.
It brings it back to exposed. So as soon as they go out, they're not looking for frogs and lizards. They're looking for quail.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you have trained them to think that that's their prey.
Yeah.
Well,
it truly is.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what bird dogs are doing.
So
I mean, it creates incredible amount of drive and desire to find birds.
There you go. That was kind of where I was going. Is what is the desired outcome? And you just explained it. It's to get them motivated to find the birds in the field.
Absolutely. And because it's competitive with them running at the litter, they all tend to become very equal. They're all competitive. And as a result, they all try harder. And they all get better.
Love it.
Yeah, I think it's a disservice by taking a puppy at 8 weeks and not having his litter mates to learn from.
I can echo that only because I've learned the hard way. Yeah. Do you have to go through this entire explanation before somebody says, okay, I'll buy a puppy that I can't have until he's 12 weeks old? Do they get it?
Well, I tend to have to explain it to everyone. But what happens is once someone gets one of my puppies, they get a second and a third and a fourth and a fifth. I've got many clients across the country that are on their fifth or sixth because they know the value of it. And obviously, my puppies cost more because I put a lot more work in them.
Yeah. Yeah, and you put a lot more birds literally into them.
Absolutely.
Well, tell me a little bit about training in general, and then we'll develop more of that as we get down into the downhill side of the podcast. But generally speaking, how do you define a finished dog that leaves your kennel? What do you want a dog, an older dog? How would you define finished?
A dog that is reliably steady on his game. A dog that remains on point until a bird is shot. Steady the wing is shot. I train it all the time, but most bird hunters don't give a hoot about it. But they do want a dog that's steady. And if a dog is steady to shot, that's where most people want their dogs. I don't ever want to see a dog leave here that's moving in and helping to handle a flush. And unfortunately, if you watch the TV shows with the hunting guides, it seems that every dog's in there flushing.
Hey, quit watching my show if you don't like that. No, I know how you feel about that.
Gotten better now that English cockers are spread all over.
Yes.
People actually keeping their dogs steady and letting the little cockers do the flushing. So
yeah, and you know, that's good for everybody, including the safety of the other dogs. So I'm happy to see the cocker spaniel thing taken off as well.
Yeah, I am too.
Well, we got a lot more to talk about, but you're going to get a quick break here. And so I'm going to talk a little bit, and then we're going to have our Handle It segment where we dive deep into feeding for peak performance. And then Mark will be back with us to discuss more about Sarah Setter Kennels and his training philosophy and how we might be able to apply some of that here. So, Mark, you stand by. Everybody else, pay attention. And the Upland Nation podcast is brought to you in part by Happy Jack Dog Care Remedies. Learn more at happyjackinc.com. That's happyjackinc.com. They got something for every problem you're going to face. It might save yourself a trip to the veterinarian. A lot of these things are pretty basic, whether it's skin, coat, parasites, pads, and everything in between. Learn more about their products at happyjackinc.com. Well, welcome back. The Handle It segment this week is going to extend itself just a bit because we have a very special guest on the other end of the line. Dr. Tim Hunt is a veterinarian. He's a sled dog competitor. And of course, you know him because he's the provider of all Flick's foods. And I say foods because Tim has got a number of formulations for various reasons. This time of year, we're all looking at how to improve our dog's performance for next season, and that's where we're going to start. Tim Hunt, DVM, welcome to the Upland Nation podcast.
Thank you very much for having me on.
It's good.
I look forward to talking with you about dogs.
The same here. I mean, it's our favorite subject, right?
It definitely is. They're amazing creatures, the best athletes I've ever seen.
And you speak of that as if you have some experience. The sled dog world is kind of a romantic world for a lot of us. We all look to sled dog racers for, I guess I'll call it, expertise, especially when it comes to conditioning and nutrition for our dogs. What is the top line on that? What did you learn as a sled dog racer that you think has the most relevance to bird dog people?
Well, I think they're very similar in three facts. One is training. You have to have the proper training ahead of your event or you're never going to get through it, regardless of all the silver bullets you might have up your sleeve. Two is genetics, meaning that you got to have good dogs or it's not going to work. A Schnauzer is a nice dog, but probably not meant to be an upland bird dog. You could probably work them and train them into it, but there are maybe better selections than a Schnauzer. And then lastly is nutrition. If you don't have the right fuel going into those athletic dogs that have been selected for that type of activity, it's just not going to work. So you have to put all three of those foundations together to really have a successful outcome.
Well, you know, and I want to thank you on the air, if you will, for reminding us again, and I constantly forget. None of it matters if you haven't started with a well-conditioned, well-bred dog. After that, though, it really is all about the fuel you put in the tank. And today, in particular, I'm just thinking of some of my hunts this past season, which were 3, 4, and 5 days long. And while I was walking 6 to 10 or 12 miles, Flick was running 20 to 35 miles that day. What are the important aspects of diet when it comes to making sure a dog can actually handle that kind of mileage in a day?
Well, the first thing is that they have to be on the proper diet long in advance of the actual training beginning. Their body has to assimilate or get used to a food, and that can take a good month for that to happen. And what people often will do is go to a less expensive food, meaning a less or less protein inclusive food in the off season because it's going to save a few bucks. And they don't realize that by then putting them on to that regular hunting food come the first day of training, they're already behind the eight ball by about a month. So I think the first thing you have to realize is that you need to use a proper food ahead of training or just keep them on the proper food year round so their body is used to what's coming into their fuel station, into their furnace, I should say. So that's probably one of the first and biggest mistakes I'll see people make, both as a rookie and then as an advanced person, that they just use the wrong food in the off season or too close into season. So that's the first thing I would consider as important.
Boy, and I remember even way back, Larry Mueller's book, which is probably 40 years old now, started talking about that before anybody else. Once we believe in that, and we only learn that the hard way, I'm afraid, what are the important building blocks of a dog food for in-field stamina on a day-to-day basis?
Sure. Besides getting used to that food, is we have to look at what kind of food we're going to choose to feed that dog. And the analogy I always look at is you can't fit a square peg into a round hole. There's lots of good foods out on the market, but they're not all meant for the same purpose or the same job description that your dog might have. So if you have a busy dog that's going to be working hard, you got to find a food that was developed for that dog versus trying to use something that's just expensive, which might be a good food for a dog that's sitting on a couch, but for a dog that's active, it starts to fail, and you see it failing for several different ways. One is just the stool consistency starts to go bad. Stool should stay solid, for instance, during exercise and during rest. And if you see that change, that's a failure of the food. Two is the stamina that you describe. Certain foods can definitely promote stamina in addition to other parts of the training and recovery scheme that we'll talk about here today. So you want to make sure you find a food that's been proven in the field for the activity level of your dog. And that's why, for instance, we have several different activity levels of dog food depending on the purpose of your dog. Some of the foods we use in Alaska for the sled dogs might not be indicated for an upland field trial dog, okay, and vice versa. So we just have to understand that there's kind of a ladder or a stepwise look at how we select our food based on what activity your dog's going to do. What? You really can't take some grocery store food and expect it to work very well for a hunting dog unless your expectations are pretty low.
And while they have been in the past, they are no longer that low. You know,
For many years in the Iditarod, the elder mushers would tell us to bring a comb so we could comb the dog's fur out in the back so all the poop that they were pooping out, the diarrhea because the food stunk, wouldn't stick on the fur when they came into a checkpoint. And I thought, are you serious? This is what I'm going to do to solve the problem, is comb my dog instead of feed him properly? You know, it's to that level of rationalization, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and we've all seen that. The bird dog world is just as bad when it comes to that kind of advice. You know, there are three basic components to any food. There's carbohydrates, there's fats, and there's proteins. When it comes to day-to-day in the field stamina, how would you rank those?
Yeah, I think you have to understand that dogs are different than people. They run on fat. Their fuel is supposed to be fat, and you can think of fat as like fuel oil, okay, going into a furnace versus chunks of wood, which would represent carbohydrates. The fuel oil trickles into a furnace and gets the heat going and warms your house up, where with a whole wood approach, you've got to throw in a lot of logs to heat for the same number of BTUs. Dogs are no different. You can't fuel that dog properly using a carbohydrate-based diet. Okay, they're not going to work well on that. They'll do it, but they won't perform well. You have to fuel those dogs on a fat-based diet. And what that means is you want to have a fat-based diet that's going into them of at least 20% or higher. And you're not going to go cold turkey from something, let's say, a 10% diet to 20% diet. You're going to have some ramifications there. You have to stepwise them into that, where we up the fat level slowly so they acclimate to it, and then their body kind of sets up for success by getting used to it. So to me, a 20% fat diet is going to be the minimum I'm going to consider for an active dog.
And you've got formulation. I think I'm on Momentum most of the year, but that's about 20, I think about 24% fat, if I recall. And that works well for Flick, a little bit more than that, and all of a sudden we do start seeing loose stools and things like that. But can you do that on the day, or is this something that is fat like the other aspects of nutrition? It needs to be on a regular, consistent, and in advance basis.
It does. The amount of fat you feed a dog can actually influence the VO2 max of a dog, meaning how well they can handle oxygen. So just with dietary changes alone, with additional fat, you can increase the VO2 max of a dog, meaning that they can have more stamina. Okay, just from that, it's fascinating how their system is made to rely on fat, and how once you get the right fat levels in, it actually responds proactively to become more efficient. And that's just the nature of evolution. So one thing I'll see again is by going off a high fat diet, you'll start to run into recovery problems, stamina problems, and the like, and even injury problems for that matter. So you just have to remember they're different than us, and we have to feed them differently than us. And there are many smart people out there that can put a food together, and I was not one of them early on. I did not understand this until I was in the sled dog world for a number of years to actually see the cause and effect of proper nutrition on these dogs.
You know, and it's funny because you're, among others, you're one of the guys who's put two and two and two together and gotten six out of it by fundamentally experimenting on sled dogs, because you know, what a great laboratory that whole world is.
Absolutely. Yes, they taught me everything about how to feed them. And again, we're not trying to feed, you know, the guy in North Dakota's dog like a sled dog, but the principles are extremely similar. We just have to take it down a few notches, but they respond the same way as these Alaskan Huskies.
Well, let's talk about fat then, because it sounds like that's the critical factor on a day-to-day basis. If we got a dog that's going to hunt 3, 4, 5, 10 days in a row, and some do, the sources, because your diets have a variety of fat sources, and of course, everybody who listens to the podcast knows that they can find out where all those fats came from. But what is the rationale behind a variety of fat sources?
Yeah, because they have essential and non-essential needs for different fatty acids, I like varieties of sources, so I make sure I cover all the bases that's required. The other thing that comes about is how quickly they can combust or utilize certain fats. Some are slower burners than others. I see that much more as a factor in super cold environments when we're up in Alaska versus a dog that's hunting in North Dakota, for instance. So that's not going to be as big a variable with a kibble diet versus additional fat in the field. And then you want to have a really good marine source of omega-3 fatty acids in the mix too, because the fatty acid profile that comes from the ocean, the omega-3s are really, really beneficial for a working dog, let alone any dog that's just sitting on the couch. You can get omega-3 fatty acids from plant-based sources, but the efficaciousness of that is much less than the ocean-based types. It's almost like a 1-to-4 or 1-to-5 ratio. You need 5 times as much plant-based omega-3s as ocean-based omega-3s for the same function. And as we bring more of it into play, it has all these side benefits to it too. When I, stepping back a second here, because you asked really great questions, when I formulate a dog food, I look at it as like an orchestra. We've got 100 seats for that orchestra. We've got 5 tubas and 3 drums and so on and so forth. I want to have every seat in that orchestra playing an instrument if I can, versus having a wasted spot where it's empty or filled by someone that doesn't know how to play an instrument. So when we construct these diets, I want to make sure we're fulfilling those 100 seats as most effectively as we can for things that actually do something for the dog versus just window dressing. So I'm going to try to choose that ocean-based omega-3 over, let's say, a pea protein or a pea fiber kind of omega-3, because it really benefits the dog. It might drive the price a little bit, but I'm utilizing an orchestra seat that ultimately is going to lead to less stool production and a better dog on the field.
You know,
it really does work.
And I might just add to that, the dog only has a finite amount of storage space in his gut. And and if we're overloading it with basically unusable anything, we're wasting that space. Like you said, the seat is occupied by a guy who doesn't know the fingerings.
Right. Exactly right. Or if you try to load up all the calories via carbohydrates, which have half the number of calories as fat, you're going to take more seats up from a carb in that orchestra than if we just utilize fat, which will take up half as many seats. thus leaving more seats for other more functional ingredients.
And
so that's why dogs utilizing fat, we got to bring fat to the table, you know, and we can't just throw it at them on the day of going out on that training or that actually performance episode up in North Dakota. We need to bring it into them over time so they get used to the music they're going to play, you know.
And if you could put five tubas, it'd be a great band. But being a former tuba player, I would lobby for that. but one is enough in most cases. That's what I've been told, at least. Tim Hunt, doctor of veterinary medicine, sled dog competitor, and also the developer of Dr. Tim's Performance Dog Foods. You know how to find them, drtims.com. Tim, it's great to talk with you. Thanks for being a part of the Upland Nation podcast. Let's do it again real soon.
I'm glad to help. If anyone ever has any questions, they're welcome to email me through the company. I answer all the emails myself.
There you have it, folks. Talk to the guy who's in charge at Dr. Tim's Performance Dog Foods. Thanks again.
You bet. Take care.
And we're back with Mark Fulmer of Sarah Setter Kennels in Aiken, South Dakota. Yeah, man, I'm going to talk about a Freudian slip. Aiken, South Carolina. SarahSetter.com. That's SarahSetter.com. Mark, you still there?
I'm here.
Good. And the connection stuck. That's a good thing.
Right.
You talked about clicker training. I get it. It, you know, I have been using the beeper, I guess I'll call it the tone part of my training collars for all sorts of things over the years. In fact, we're working on a little bit of that today, but you've moved that over, and I get it, because puppies, like you said, can't wear a training collar. How are you using clickers? I mean, I have yet to have anybody explain in a way that I can comprehend how to use that, as opposed to just saying good dog.
Right. Well, first, you have to understand the rules of reinforcement. They were scattered throughout a couple of chapters in Karen Pryor's book, Don't Shoot the Dog.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually went back and outlined it. And I'll just quickly read through these 10 real quick. Number one, you raise criteria in an increment small enough so the subject always has a realistic chance for reinforcement. You train one thing at a time. Do not try to shape for two criteria at the same time. Three is always put the current level response onto a variable schedule of reinforcement before adding or raising criteria. When introducing a new criterion, temporarily relax the old ones. Stay ahead of your subject. Plan ahead your shaping completely. But if the subject makes a sudden progress, you're aware of what to reinforce next. And basically, it's like a chess game. You got to be two steps ahead of your puppy. Because if he gives you something where you're going to, you go ahead and reward him for it. You don't make him go back and take each individual step. You don't change trainers in midstream. You can have several trainers per trainee, but each trainer trains only one behavior while the dog's learning. In shaping a behavior, is not a listening progress. You find another way to do it. And there's many ways to get behaviors or trainers to think them up. Another is don't interrupt a training session gratuitously. That constitutes a punishment, a dog when he's actively learning. And if a behavior deteriorates, you just go back a step or two. And if you'll think of the training process as going up steps, if he falters at the fifth step, you drop back to the third and go third, fourth, fifth, and frequently they'll jump right onto the sixth. You just go backwards for a second and bring them up. And then obviously, end each session with a high note, but always stop while you're ahead. Now, the principle behind a conditioned reinforcer is the fact that there is something that's associated with a reward coming. In this case, it's a clicker. Dolphin people use whistles for years. A good trainer can use his voice. And with the voice, it's very important to make it short and sweet. Instead of babbling, "Oh, you're such a good dog, Joe," you should say, "Good."
Yeah.
And what you're after is marking time exactly when the animal gives you the best behavior that you have seen yet. And a good way to demonstrate it with a puppy is you put a 7-8 week old puppy on the floor in front of you and you start backing away from it. When it starts coming towards you, you click and you hand it a treat.
Yeah.
And then you back away from it again. And when it comes towards you, you click and hand it a treat. And pretty soon you can't run fast enough backwards to get away from the puppy. And what he's doing is developing an association that he will get a treat when he hears that click sound. And when I'm training puppies, I teach that behavior first. And as soon as it's reliable, I'll bring in a second trainer and I'll have them do the same thing very briefly so the puppy learns them. And then I step back in and the two of us start working with the puppy 10 feet apart. And this would be the second lesson with the puppy. And lessons are generally less than 10 minutes, probably closer to 5 minutes in length when we're training.
Mm-hmm.
But very quickly, we can go from 5 feet to 10 feet to 20 feet in that second lesson. Third lesson, we can stretch it out to 30 or 40 feet. And by the fifth lesson, we're running the length of my training building, which is 60 feet. And at that point, we actually start hiding from the puppy in and around anything that may be here. I mean, I literally can sit down at the chair off to the side and the puppy no longer can see me at 7 weeks old. You know, we all know that they don't have great vision, but truly, if you're not moving, and a young puppy cannot pick you out of a background. I have stood up against a 6x6 post and had a puppy come straight towards me and turn around and leave because you couldn't tell I was not the post.
I'm sorry, but I'm going to tell you, Mark, you've opened my eyes to something I had no idea was as dramatic as that. I didn't know puppies had such poor vision at that age.
Well, let's go back to that brain development again.
Yeah.
A puppy when he's 7-8 weeks old or 7 or 8 days old has no sight, mm-hmm. and pretty much no hearing.
Yeah.
Maybe 10, 11 days when the eyes start to open, they're opening because the brain has grown enough to function to use the eyes.
Sure.
And same thing with the ears. As that brain grows, those things start working. It doesn't mean they're working 100%. And there's a tremendous change in puppy vision between 6 and 9 weeks. I mean, it really is. It's amazing what they can and can't see at those ages. So, you know, we all assume that a puppy is a little dog, and it's not. It's truly like an infant. And we have a hard time thinking of like that. Here's an explanation I give people a lot. Many years ago now, they rewrote the 1 year equals 7 for a dog's life. And now it's for the first 2 years, 1 equals 12. Every month equals a year of a dog's life.
Okay.
And when you break that down, every day of a puppy's life is equal to 12 of a child's. So if you leave a puppy in a kennel for 2.5 days, he's been there for a month.
And
think about your child alone for a month and where it would be as an infant.
Yeah.
You know, it's all relative because they still have their needs and they get fed, et cetera. But the brain is developing so rapidly that any missed opportunity there, you won't recover again. To further push that along, a 6-month-old puppy is a 6-month-old child. I mean, excuse me, a 6-month-old puppy is a 6-year-old child. A 12-month-old puppy is equal to a 12-year-old child. Now, at 18 months, basically full grown, out of high school, that's when we hit our puppies at 18 months when they really can become a handful because they're grown puppies. And, you know, they can be great or they can really be a pain.
Yeah, and just like teenagers.
Exactly. And by the time you get to 2, you've got 24 years, 24 months. Out of school, out of college, probably got a job and married, settle down. Well, that's when bird dogs settle down, is after 2. So every month is equal to a year. And if people will think like that, it will change the way you think about training.
Well, you hit it first off, and Larry Mueller has been a real inspiration to me too, and still everybody. If you haven't read his Speed Train Your Own Bird Dog book, it's a little dated and a little bit interesting in places, but still incredibly useful.
Right, absolutely.
Pardon me. So, you're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden. That's Mark Fulmer of Sarasota Kennels in Aiken, South Carolina. Got it right that time. The puppy thing ultimately ends up paying off in ways down the road. But let's focus on this just a little bit more. Now, when we have a puppy and we're trying to do what as much as we can, like you do, and mold that pup really early on in its life, what are some of the things we should avoid at all costs, you know, say in that first 12 weeks?
There's not much I can think of that I would avoid. Everything for a puppy is experiences, you know, and it's controlled experiences. You don't want to overdo it. You obviously don't want an aggressive dog to attack the puppy, those sort of things. Exposure to loud noises. Obviously, you don't want to take the risk of going through that first fear period and causing the dog to be scared of gunfire. You know, that said, when I run puppies on birds every day, weather permitting, from 8 weeks to 12 weeks when they leave here. And I mean 7 days a week, because they've been on birds you know, for 4 months, 4 weeks rather. They've had 30 encounters with birds. And that's a lot of bird work. Where most people train their own dog at home, you know, that's half a year for some people.
Oh, yeah.
Or a couple of months. So, you know, puppies get a tremendous amount of exposure. And because they have had that much bird exposure and they're all crazy about finding birds, I can start introducing gunfire at 13 weeks. And what I do is puppies run as a group until 12 weeks. And then puppies that are going home earlier or at 12 weeks, they leave. Then I have some clients who will actually leave a puppy with me for another month of training. And those puppies start training individually. And immediately I go out and they point a bird. And with nobody else out there, they stand the bird tight and let me walk up and flush it. And as soon as they flush and they're chasing, I start introducing gun sounds. I've actually talked to 3 or 4 of the dog supply companies, and I have recommended a dozen times that they should feature the little airbags, air pillows that comes in packing from Amazon. So they make a great introduction to gunfire that's legal to use in the city. So you could pop airbags, and with a little practice, you can make them loud, you can make them soft. But it's what I use to introduce puppies to the first sound of a pop.
Boy, and who doesn't have a whole bunch of those laying around?
But I'm a connoisseur. I can touch one or see it from 10 feet away and know whether it's a good pop or a bad pop.
Oh, that's funny. I love it.
Some of them have a lot of stretch and you just can't make them pop. And others, you know, do a really good job.
The idea that you could use that anywhere, anytime is just, it's golden.
Yeah, it sure is. But, you know, I go from there. Then I go to a crimp blank gun while the puppy's chasing birds after he lets me flush it. And once I go past the crimp, I go to a 209 and then I go to a 410. And generally, I can go to a 410 safely in about 2 weeks. Of course, that's 14 days in a row going from a air pillow to a 410. But as soon as I get to that 410, I will try to shoot every bird that the puppy lets me flush. And frequently, I will kill 35 or 40 quail before a puppy leaves here at 4 months of age. So it has had its first bird season at 4 months old.
All right, so we're talking about feeding quail to a puppy at a certain age for a certain narrow time period. Okay, how many days?
4 days.
Okay. So that's the end of eating quail. When you shoot one over a puppy, you don't want them to bring it back or bring part of it back after swallowing the other part. Am I correct on that?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right.
I start shooting birds for puppies. I let them drag a 20-foot long parachute cord. So that when they find a bird, you know, I'm right there behind them and I find the end of the cord and pick it up and gently milk them in, praising them all the time. And within 2 or 3 days, I have puppies delivering to hand or delivering close by, not necessarily hand. But I can actually refine that delivering to hand by using a place board back up in the kennel. You toss a bird out and dog leaves from the place board. As soon as he picks it up, you've got him on a check cord and you ease him back. And as he gets close, you say place. And he's been jumping up there for several weeks, so he hops right up. when he hops up, I offer a hot dog and he spits a quail out. So I get to deliver it ahead. He gets a piece of a hot dog.
And you just answered the next question, Mark. Boy, you are a good interviewer. You like hot dog bits for the treats on puppies?
I much prefer them. Yeah. Start off with, they're economical.
Yeah.
The way I slice a hot dog is I slice it probably about the thickness of a nickel, maybe thinner.
Yeah.
I slice it 90% through, and I slice it all the way through at the quarter mark. So I've got little pieces of hot dog that have 7 or 8 pieces that are connected, and it's easy to hold that piece in my hand. And yes, I literally can thumb and just pop them off as I need them.
Oh, I love that idea. That's
if they're all cut and wet, they tend to stick, and it's hard to deliver one timely. And so that's the way I do it. And literally, I get about 30 treats per hot dog. So a pack of hot dogs gives you 240 treats. And you don't want to think about what it costs to buy 240 treats at the pet store.
No, you know, if you think about it on a per pound basis, it's scary.
And the puppies prefer them. One thing that I do is as soon as those puppies go to dry dog food, I cut up hot dogs in little pieces and I mix it in with the dry dog food so they get accustomed to the texture and taste of a hot dog before I start clicker training.
They never don't know what a hot dog is about.
Right, exactly.
Okay, well, beyond a pack of hot dogs, which will last a long time for most of us, what other items do you think a puppy trainer needs to have on hand, and how would we use some of those that maybe we haven't thought about?
Well, what I need is a kennel for a puppy to get in, and I prefer one that doesn't have much of a lip for him to have to climb over.
Yeah.
So it's easy for him to go in. A place board. Now, something that I do that's a bit unusual, the place board that I designed is actually a series of 3 place boards that are consistently smaller so that when I stack them, the puppies generally can climb up like climbing up stairs. And the top place board is not a whole lot bigger than a puppy. So what happens is when he climbs up there and he moves around, he falls off. And he will climb right back up there to get his hot dog. Once he learns to stand there, he's standing still so he doesn't fall off.
It's a flat, low barrel on its side.
Well,
I mean, that's really the effect you're getting.
It is. It is. But the puppy gets up himself.
Yeah.
From day. And the nice thing about it, if I'm training a retriever or an obedience dog, I teach them to sit on place.
Yeah.
But I teach bird dogs to stand on place. So if they get up there and sit, I simply walk around to the other side and they stand up to face me. And as soon as they stand, I click. And you end up doing that 8 or 10 times. And all of a sudden the puppy learns, I don't get anything from sitting, I'll stand. So you teach that standing behavior very early in a puppy's life.
Okay. So answer this one for me, Mark, because I'm grokking the clicker thing now. The clicker thing, as you said, is it says, hey, stand by, you're going to get a real treat in a moment, but that's the signal for it. And then Right. Then you have a little breathing room to deliver the food treat. Is that the idea there?
Oh, absolutely. Early in the training, especially when a puppy does something right the first time, like go in a kennel or climb up on the place board, I may rapid fire click and treat 3 or 4 times just to sort of cement the behavior.
Sure.
Because he may fall off or he may jump off, but if you simply wait, he will turn around and crawl right back up there where he got his last hot dog. And as soon as he gets back up there, it's click and treat again. And once he's up there, at first I start moving side to side as I back away, and you only back away a step or two at a time, and you click and treat and walk up and give him a treat. And you back up again, maybe get another step back, another couple of feet back, until you build it up to 20 feet. And it doesn't take long. It just takes consistency.
You've mentioned in some of your literature on your website that you don't use punishment Punishment is a loaded word, of course, and for some people that means 11 on the e-collar settings. For other people, it means a stern voice or, you know, turning away or whatever. Where do you draw the, how do you correct then?
Let me qualify that.
Yeah.
I don't use punishment with puppies.
Yeah.
And I don't use it a lot in any training, but in a lot of places it has value. And first thing everyone needs to understand, punishment is a training technique, and punishment should not be construed as abuse, which is what the animal rights industry has tried to do for years.
Yeah. And yeah.
Even Karen Pryor's organization has sort of fallen into that trap. Punishment happens every day in nature. All kinds of things, whether it's an insect stinging another one or, you know, slipping off a log. It's just a part of our natural environment, and it's foolish to try to eliminate it. But the key is you never punish out of anger. You should stop and put the dog up.
Yeah.
Punishment basically is designed to stop the behavior and to cause it not to happen again, which is very important. Say if a dog's chasing a car, you know, he gets nailed one time really good with a knee collar, and he probably will never chase a car again. Same thing with, you know, counter surfing. All it takes is a one-time correction done the right way, and it doesn't happen again. And a very important tool that people tend to snivel at is something called a bunker, which is a device that Gary Wilkes invented many, many years ago. And it's simply a towel rolled up like a gym roll.
Yeah.
And Gary had realized that when you and he did this by accident. He picked up a little throw pillow on the sofa one day and threw at a dog in the house that was doing something wrong, hit the dog in the head with a throw pillow, and the dog never did it again. And it dawned on him that, hey, that worked. So, you know, he played with it a little bit with throw pillows, and then he ended up rolling up a towel. And dogs dislike things coming at their head.
Yeah.
And it has a profound effect on them. They stop the behavior, and they don't do it anymore. And nobody has ever been hurt by a towel thrown at them. So, you know, it's powerful, but it's incredibly soft at the same time. But it stops the behavior. So, yeah, I do use punishment along the way. But most of what I do is reinforcement training.
Yeah.
Both positive and negative. And those same rules that I quoted a while ago, everyone in the dog training industry using the word enforcement in place of reinforcement. They say you take an e-collar and you reinforce a behavior. What they mean is I am enforcing a known behavior. Reinforcement is not about enforcing a new behavior, a known behavior. So they're totally different, and they're used wrong all the time. You know, using a collar for a known command is enforcement. It is not reinforcement. And it's spelled with an E instead of an I. So it's quite different. Reinforcement basically is a training technique, and it's progressive. Just like positive going up the steps, low-level stimulation is negative reinforcement. And you start low, and you go up to the next level, and then the next level. Dog complies, and you go down to the medium level, and then you go off. That's the hardest part to convey, because everyone can't get out of their mind that mashing a button is punishment.
Yeah.
Because it's electricity and it's shocking. There's incredible power in training with a knee collar properly. You know, and that said, there are only a very few collars out there that actually work well as reinforcement collars. And they all have a low, medium, and high at every level. The concept or the thought that you can go from 10 to 20 to 30 to 40 and do it efficiently, it just doesn't work. You have to look at a dial. That means you take your eye off of the dog. So it makes it, your training is not efficient. Anytime you take your eye away from the dog, if you're looking down at a dial, and I despise every e-collar out there that has a dial on it that requires you to look at it.
Yeah. Yeah. I understand exactly what you're getting at. And I've been there and done that, and so have most of the people who are listening right now.
It's Yes, keep it simple, stupid. And you know, every time you put an engineer in it and he tries to make 100 functions, you know, we're dog trainers. We're not electrical equipment operators.
Exactly. You know, Mark, we could go all night, but we're not going to. We're going to carry on again at some future date because we're barely scratching the surface about all of this stuff. Mark Fulmer is with Sarah Setter Kennels in Aiken, South Carolina. Learn all about this and a whole bunch more, including those videos and some seminar ideas at sarahsetter.com, S-A-R-A-H-S-E-T-T-E-R. Mark, you want to leave us with one more final bit of advice, and then I'll turn you loose to what's probably going to be more chores.
Okay. I want to remind people, or not remind, but to actually inform them that I've recently videotaped an entire puppy training seminar with all of the clicker work, all of the bird work, and it will be available soon on Patreon, where you can join as a subscriber. What will happen is you will have constant access to all of the videos that I put up. And this will be a continuing project. You'll start with the entire seminar so you can see the process I go through with puppies, but then I'm going to follow some of these puppies through the training process with their early development. It's like these puppies I'm shooting birds for now at 4 months old. Some of that will be available, and then how you move from there into 8 and 10 month old training.
Great.
And it will all be there, and it's going to be a very different approach that no one else has in the dog training world.
Well, there you have it. SarahSetter.com is where you get more information on all of that. Mark, I'm still intrigued, which means, like I said, we'll be carrying on this conversation in future. But for now, thanks for being on, and thanks for being a part of the Upland Nation.
Great. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you. So have I. And I hope you did too out there. We got a lot more to talk about, and we're just you know, on the downhill side, but a couple things. The first is that newsletter poll that I do every week. If you're not getting the emailed newsletter, it's called the Upland Nation Insights. Maybe you want to sign up. You do that at findbirdhuntingspots.com. It's right there on the first part of the page. Easy enough to do. Interesting, because it's one of the things I'm focusing on for a bunch of reasons, but I asked this last newsletter, do you wear eye or ear protection in the field? And I was intrigued with the answers. Eye protection, glasses of one sort or another. Almost 60% of you said, yes, I do. Ear protection, plugs or muffs or electronic versions of those, only about 10% of you. But the rest are wearing both. 30% said they're wearing something for their ears and something for their eyes, and I'm sure those are the folks we should emulate in the future. So fascinating insights. Always something to think about in the Upland Nation Insights newsletter. Some tips, some you know, advice, feedback, access to videos and these podcasts, and more, all at the Upland Nation Insights newsletter. Stick around. I have a public access tip coming up in just a moment. First, this part of the Upland Nation podcast is brought to you by Dr. Tim's Performance Dog Food. You've learned a lot from Dr. Tim over the last few minutes, and if you'd like to learn more about his dog foods, man, there's a vast assortment out there, probably a dozen different types. Go to drtims.com, click on the View All tab, and you can explore dog food by their activity level, their life stage, the main protein source, whether it's dry or wet. You got a dog with special needs, you got a particular dog breed or size. It's all right there. You can learn everything you need to know about dog food, including the nutritional rationale behind everything. Dr. Tim will deliver it to your door. And if you use the coupon code Upland Nation, you'll get a 30% discount on your first order. DRTIMS.com. tell them I sent you. Well, I was picking out photos for a story that'll end up in an Upland Almanac magazine in the near future, all about places that I finally got around to exploring after driving past for weeks or months or years. One of those was near Watertown, South Dakota. If you haven't been to Watertown, it's certainly worth going. It's a little out of the way for most of us who go to South Dakota, but well worth it. There's the Terry Redland Museum. They love hunters up there, and there's a lot of waterfowl production areas and small bodies of water that those folks up there like to use for their duck and their goose hunting, and I get it. Now, the thing is, most people drive past them if they got a pointing dog in their truck, and I thought I'd take a look at one in particular, and I'm not going to tell you which one, but I'm going to tell you that the smaller the better. This one had a little pond on it, too small for most people to bother with, but I pulled in. There was nobody else there. We found pheasants in the cattails, and I actually shot a couple, but only after my dog pointed what ended up being a raccoon pointing my dog. Okay, it could have gotten ugly, but it did not. Everybody walked away from it unscathed. I'm grateful for that. And maybe that in itself was one reason I was reminded to bring it up to you. Head for Watertown, South Dakota, and look at some of those smaller pieces of water there as upland bird habitat as well. Well, that'll put a capper on this edition of the Upland Nation podcast. Thank you, Mark Fulmer at Sarah Setter Kennels, sarahsetter.com. You can learn all about his philosophy towards puppies and training, brain development. I appreciate your being a part of the Upland Nation podcast as well. If you want to carry on the conversation, the Facebook pages are the place to do that. The Wing Shooting USA and the Upland Nation Facebook pages are wide open to discussion. I hope you'll subscribe, rate, or review us at Apple Podcasts. Thank you, Skeeter Mac, for your recent review. I'll leave you with this thought for the day. Maybe you've had it too. Quarantine has turned us into hunting dogs. We roam the house all day looking for food. We're told no if we get too close to strangers. And we get really excited about car rides. Thanks again for listening. I hope you have a great week. I'm Scott Linden. See you in the field.